Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
Scott, thank you very much, and welcome to The Exchange. I'm Deirdre Bosa, in for Kelly Evans. Here is what is ahead. The market has been resilient so far in the face of more hawkish Fed talk. Where it goes from here, at least in the near term, that could come down to one chart, says our market guest. She is here to tell us what she's watching. Plus, Treasury Secretary Yellen, she's in China, and our Sarah Eisen sat down with her in an exclusive interview. We have the headlines and why our guest says investors should prepare for rising tensions. And the three buckets of AI and one value pick for each. That is all ahead, but we will begin with today's markets. Dom Chu with the numbers. Hi, Dom.
Hey, so Dee, they're green. We're pretty much green across the screen here, but they're modest moves. And to kind of put things in context, we're just up about maybe 1 to 2/10% for the major indices. The S&P 500 is at 5211 right now, up 7 points. At the highs of the session, we were up roughly 15 points. So again, modest moves higher, but we were down 7 points at the low. So that kind of gives you the trading range so far today. The Dow Industrials, 38,943, up about 0.1%, 39 points there. And the NASDAQ Composite, 16,277, up 28 points, about 0.2% gain there. So markets at this hour, green, modestly so. One place we're keeping a close eye on is the semiconductor space. And it's not just because of the big CHIPS Act funding grant for Taiwan Semi, but a slate of analyst commentary out between Cantor Fitzgerald, KeyBank, either raising target prices or raising ratings outright. Names like NVIDIA, although it's down 0.75% right now, Applied Materials, Qualcomm, Micron, all catching a little bit of a bid here, thanks to some, in part, tailwinds from analyst calls. And by the way, for more on that story, just head over to cnbc.com/pro. Subscribers there can get the full story and analysis on some of those big calls. Watch the ETFs there as well. And then one stock, the only member of the $1 trillion market cap plus club that has not hit a record high anytime in the last 6 months has been Amazon.com. And Amazon shares are at $185.63. The reason why I'm showing you this is because at one point today, we did hit a 52-week high, but we are now just a couple dollars away from hitting a record high for Amazon. So that catch-up that's been in place since 2023 up to here is now trying to come to finally a record high. We'll keep an eye on that, Deirdre. I'll send things back over to you.
Dom, thank you very much. And we've also been tracking a shift in the dynamic at the Federal Reserve when it comes to the path of rate cuts. That dynamic is going to have some implications for investors ahead of the central bank's next meeting. Senior economics reporter Steve Fleisman is here with more. Steve, it's nuanced, but it's there.
Exactly nuanced, but it is definitely there. The Fed has been unusually unanimous over the past several years when it's come to policy cutting to zero in the face of the pandemic. Everyone agreed. Hiking over 5% to battle inflation. Everyone agreed. Now, some divisions are showing when it comes to the issue of cutting interest rates, with some in a new hawkish wing expressing more skepticism about reducing rates, greater risk about the inflation outlook. We call it, what is it? Where is it here? It's the new hawkish wing develops. These folks, sort of one cut, maybe none at all. Neil Kashkari last week talking about the issue. If inflation stalls, maybe no cuts at all. Others may feel the same way. Kashkari said it out loud. Chris Waller has said already he thinks it's probably prudent to hold longer than previously thought at the current restrictive rate. Add in Lori Logan talking about the Dallas Fed chief, talking about meaningful risks to continued inflation progress. Fed Governor Bowman gives a whole speech about all of the inflation risks that are out there. And of course, Rafael Bostic on our air and elsewhere talks about the idea of his base case is one cut and not until the fourth quarter. Now, where's the chair? That's what matters the most for this whole discussion. I say he puts himself in the center by saying the recent inflation readings have not materially changed his outlook and that it will still likely be appropriate to lower rates at some time this year. Notice he's not telling us how many. But then there's Mary Dialla from San Francisco, Loretta Mester from Cleveland. They're still on board with their baseline being three cuts at least. All of this hawkish speak, though, Resonating with markets where the probability of a June rate cut is hovering around the 50% line. Oh, I don't have that here. That's right. That's right there. You can see that's down from 65% before the strong jobs report. July is now down to 68%. So you can say that's kind of in play, too. All right. J.P. Morgan economists on Friday night shifting their call for the first cut to July from June. Others maintain their June cut after the strong jobs report. So the divisions at the Fed, they're not enormous. It seems most would cut if the data support it. Most would back off if the data clearly show inflation accelerating. But hawks and doves revealing themselves by their level of concern about the risks and their outlooks. Those concerns are pronounced enough, Deirdre, to raise questions about the number and the timing of rate cuts this year.
Yeah, a ton of Fed speak to sort through, which you have been doing. Let's stick around, Steve. Let's get to our next guest. She says that while the market has been fairly resilient alongside more hawkish rhetoric so far, the level of the 10-year could become a deciding factor in where the market goes from here, at least in the near term. For more, let's bring in Lizanne Saunders. Lizanne, you just heard from Steve, and you know, it sounded to me like this should be more of a plot twist than it actually is playing out in the markets. As you have said as well, been very resilient.
It has, but at the index level, there's been a lot of churn under the surface and rotation and leadership shifts. And I think that reflects some of this uncertainty as it relates to Fed policy. Obviously, the economy has been resilient in the face of the market expectations going from 6 or 7 cuts starting in March at the beginning of the year to now maybe even less than 3 cuts and not starting until mid-year. But because of economic resilience, you saw that leadership shift toward the traditional cyclical, you know, energy and materials, to some degree, industrials, financials. And I think that's where you get a better sense of what the market is doing and what it says about the macro environment, the Fed environment, and an uncertainty there. But, you know, we're still playing these gymnastics around, you know, when will they start, how many cuts? And it's just a silly exercise at this point because it's going to be a function of the data. And every week brings another, you know, set of data points that could move that needle.
Yeah, Lizanne, you called the FOMC, I think you were joking here, the Federal Open Mouth Committee, because we've had so many comments over the last few weeks. Is it too much?
Well, it adds to the uncertainty. You know, we're not in the Greenspan era where his voice was the only one that had the microphone, that had the megaphone. And it is the way it is at this point. There are times where they're very aligned and you don't get a lot of volatility associated with Fed speakers. This doesn't happen to be one of those moments. And it wouldn't surprise me if at the point we get some sort of action on the part of the Fed that you might not have everybody on the same page. So, you know, let's assume the next move is a cut. It wouldn't surprise me if there was maybe a dissent or two at that point.
Okay. Steve, this all raises the stakes for CPI and PPI.
I just want to comment on that last comment, which is I take a little bit more comfort that there's more disagreement. Mm. Kind of bugs me when everybody's on the same page. Makes me think that perhaps the committee is victim of its own kind of groupthink. And I think Lizanne would agree there are differences on the outlook in the market, and those should be reflected, I think, on the Fed. So, first of all, you asked the question, is it too much Fed speak? When we get to a point where the market is dramatically mispricing the Fed ahead of a meeting, then I think there's too much cacophony. But we're not there yet. The market shows incredible intelligence, incredible ability to discern. I think we'll be talking for a long time why the market, after one of the Fed meetings, started pricing 6 rate cuts.
Right.
I didn't hear that, and I thought that was wrong on the part of the market. But the onus always goes on the Fed and their own communication. If the market got it wrong, then somehow the Fed got their communication
wrong. Well, we're looking to the speakers, but then we're also looking at the data, right? So which one is kind of having conflicting signals? Is it how they're interpreting it?
It's together. It's the data and their interpretation of the data that you have to do. That's why we presented this nuanced analysis there, which is that data into what? Into the brains and the minds and the outlooks of the Fed folks, and then out with policy.
Right. So then when it comes to that data, Lizanne, we're looking to CPI and PPI this week. If you were in the camp that you want to see a rate cut sooner rather than later, what do you need to see? Is sticky okay as long as inflation isn't reaccelerating?
No, I don't think sticky is okay, at least not in terms of a green light for the Fed to cut. I agree with Steve. I mean, the market was way over its skis. Mm-hmm. And it actually wasn't because the Fed wasn't providing the right information. I think they were, and they were pushing back on the notion of a pivot as soon as March with 6 or 7 rate cuts. That just didn't make any sense based on the data. And what I find interesting is the parlor game of will it be June, will it be July, how many, is often not expressed with because, and then fill in the blank, because we'll see a rolling over again in CPI or PPI or PCE or, you know, core services X housing. I think it's a function of the data. You know, the Fed, it did express some hope, at least maybe confidence, that the recent uptick, especially in things like the 3-month annualized change, had a lot of seasonal components to it. But this is sort of the test case, because we're past the point where you can continue to blame seasonal. So if you don't see a rolling over in inflation, I think that is very supportive of the Fed staying in pause mode. And I wouldn't be surprised if you heard some of that rhetoric.
As Azen always done, she really put her finger on the issue of what are separates the hawks and the doves here, which is those who saw these January, February numbers less of a bump and more of a trend, that's what makes them more hawkish right now. Whereas some were saying, you know what, you got the January seasonal effect that kind of continues into February, and we're still confident, which, by the way, I want to say extends to even the hawks there. Their baseline forecast is their confidence that inflation comes down. And then we had like Tom Lee on this morning, and he's like, I am confident in the outlook for rate cuts because of my personal or my company's outlook on inflation. If that's where you're at, right, then go ahead and trade it.
Okay, let's take the other side of that, right? He's optimistic. And Jamie Dimon is someone else who has talked about the economy recently. He tends to have a more pessimistic view, but he kind of reiterated that again in his J.P. Morgan annual shareholders letter. What is he seeing that perhaps maybe Fed members are not on the economy and the possibility of a soft landing? Lizanne?
Well, so I think that there are, you know, tiny little cracks, even in the labor market data. Friday's report was pretty much positive across the board, but you could quibble with other indicators within the labor market outside of the jobs report, like the increase in layoff announcements, the increase in multiple job holders. So I think the concern may be that those tiny little cracks start to widen out and that some of the leading indicators like layoff announcements work this time as a tell of what is yet to come down the pike. I haven't read the Jamie Dimon note, so I don't know specifically what he was focusing on, but anybody that has a weaker economic outlook, it's usually because they believe there will be a faltering in the labor market.
Zan, we're going to have to go real quick, but could you give us the Charles Schwab view and or your view about inflation? Are you confident inflation is coming down?
Generally, but not in a straight line. And I think it may be a stretch to get it to the actual 2% target anytime soon.
Well, Zan, Steve, thank you very much for being with
Thanks
us.
Thanks for letting me do a little bit of reporting.
Of course,
right,
anytime, anytime. Take a look. We're going to make this actionable now. Take a look at the CNBC Magnificent 7 Index. You know who those names are. Up more than 70% in 1 year. AI, of course, one of the main catalysts here. But my next guest is focusing on names beyond big tech for the next leg of AI growth. He has arranged them into 3 separate categories: AI enablers, supporters, and users. And he brings a top value pick in each. Joining me now for more is Aaron Dunn, co-head of Value Equity at Morgan Stanley Investment Management. Aaron, thanks for being with us. What is a value pick? How do you determine that? Is it a more reasonable valuation? Because we've seen sort of the value in the AI space just kind of go to the moon over the last year.
Yeah, our team really focuses on intrinsic value. So we look at what's a really an undervalued stock or an undervalued company in the marketplace. That's how we define value. It's not relative value. And I think, you know, when you're looking at some of the growth rates, they're pretty eye-popping for a lot of these stocks. But we really focus on, for our clients, is finding opportunity in the market that has been overlooked, in our opinion. And as you said, there's a couple buckets. I put some ideas in here, and we can talk about those.
Yeah, please do, because a lot of the focus, at least in this early stage, has been on chips or the semiconductors, seen as the picks and shovels of the AI shift. Where else are you looking?
Yeah, so in the enabler side, that's what I would we'll start there. And I think Micron is one that we've held actually for quite a while. And the reason we initially entered Micron was because you have a consolidated memory chip business. It's an old commodity business, as most tech people would suggest. But when you have a consolidated industry, you start to have better pricing power. And what's really occurred with that, you had a down cycle. And the one reason we really liked it was the balance sheet was exceptional, right? They entered the downturn with net cash on the balance sheet. So that gives us a buffer of safety. What has happened for Micron, though, is with NVIDIA's GPU development, they've also developed a high bandwidth memory, HBM. So this gives it sits right along next to the GPU. They've got a really good position with NVIDIA as a partner in that. That also allows 30% energy efficiency savings. NVIDIA talked about that as well when they had their most recent developer conference. And so in our view, there's a lot here to like about Micron. And if you go back to the kind of 2021, 2020 period, there was a real shortage of memory chips.
Right.
And we really had a pinch. We feel like you're back at that point also. So there's a couple things going on with Micron that we think you still get a really nice valuation and a lot of upside.
Let me ask you about another name, Snowflake. It feels kind of controversial for, let's call it, AI enthusiasts right now. It was seen sort of as maybe this earlier play, a lot of data analytics, but others have pointed out slowing growth, been slower to embrace AI in terms of M&A activity. It's sort of abrupt CEO transition. Where are you on this name?
Yeah, so Snowflake's not one we hold or we invest in, so I don't really want to speak to that as an investor. I'll just say, I think there's a lot of places here within, the spaces we operate where there's a lot of opportunity. And we do look for management changes and stuff, as you mentioned, with Snowflake. And I think that's a key way to create value for our clients. But I think just focusing on the rest of the value chain within AI gives us plenty of opportunity.
Tell me about the AI supporters. You say that they're the least understood area today and perhaps some of the best opportunities.
Yeah, there's been a lot of discussion about it. And I think when I say supporters, I'm thinking utilities. Utilities were the worst relative performance in 40 years last year as a sector. It's off to a slow start again this year relative to the market. But it's actually very interesting. The compound annual growth rate of electricity demand for many decades prior to the 2000 period was 4% plus. And then we entered this period of really flat demand. What we're seeing with AI today is a reemergence of growth within the utility sector. So how do these hyperscalers develop and provide or get the electricity they need to develop these data centers? And that's going to be through the utility sector. You saw a nuclear deal that Amazon did to secure some nuclear power. That's considered green, or it's more increasingly being considered green energy. So we would look at a company like NextEra, clear leader in renewable development, got a lot of competitive advantages across the sector for helping municipal utilities across the country and their own pipeline, frankly, to develop renewables to supply to data centers. We think that's extremely interesting.
Thank you so much for your picks. Certainly, the shift is going to require a lot of compute power. Thanks for being with us, Aaron Dunn. Still ahead, we are sticking with AI, from value investing to venture capital. The former CEO of Amazon's One Medical joins us with how he's finding the next generation of healthcare innovation. But first, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen says she's keeping everything on the table, including tariffs, if China doesn't slow its government subsidies. Our Sarah Eisen sat down with her today and joins us next with what the visit means for U.S.-China relations. The Exchange is back right after this.
This is The Exchange on CNBC.
NetCredit is here to say yes to a personal loan or line of credit when other lenders say no. Apply in minutes and get a decision as soon as the same day. Loans offered by NetCredit or lending partner banks and serviced by NetCredit. Application subject to review and approval. Learn more at netcredit.com/partner. NetCredit, credit to the people.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Well, Welcome back to the Exchange. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen is wrapping up her second trip to China since taking the position, meeting with a number of Chinese officials. She also sat down with our own Sarah Eisen for an exclusive interview. Sarah is in Beijing. It's late night there, Sarah. I know you've been on air all day.
We've been on air all day. It's 1:20 in the morning, but this is a big story. And Janet Yellen, Treasury Secretary, just wrapped up a very busy few days, first in Guangzhou in the south, which is the advanced manufacturing hub, and then here in Beijing. We followed her from the Great Hall of the People, where she met with the number two leader, Premier Li, to local lunch with the Beijing mayor, to meet with students at Peking University. Overall, she was very well received, and she said this afternoon in a news conference at the ambassador's residence that Chinese-U.S. relations are on a firmer footing, a better place than they were a year ago. However, she did deliver two tough messages, confrontational messages in particular, as they relate to China and the economy. She did spend a great deal of time complaining about overcapacity or China flooding the world with cheap EVs and solar panels. And she also threatened real consequences if Chinese companies help Russia help fuel its war machine against Ukraine. So I asked her whether sanctions on Chinese companies were coming. Listen.
It's not only Chinese companies. We would feel that any, particularly any financial institution that facilitated trade in dual-use goods or strictly military goods in violation of our sanctions and aiding Russia's military, we would consider sanctioning. The president issued a recent executive order that would enable Treasury to impose sanctions on financial institutions that are found to be doing this in a systematic way. And we've not used this tool yet, but it is one that would be available. And what I've tried to make clear is that we stand ready to act if we see significant violations by, especially by financial institutions.
And that warning came on the day that Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov arrived here in Beijing for two-day talks with the Chinese about strengthening their relationship. Look, the message was received okay, in part because of Yellen's cordial nature. Also, she is a well-respected economist. We saw that in a number of meetings here. They wanted to know what she thought about the overall economy. And also, the U.S. is coming from a place of strength right now. That dynamic has shifted a bit, where China's economy has been weak and disappointing. I got a chance to ask Secretary Yellen about the recent jobs report, showed more than 300,000 jobs added in the month of March, another month with the unemployment rate below 4%. She said it's evidence that the U.S. is firing on all cylinders right now. And she still thinks, despite some hotter reads lately, that inflation will keep returning down, keep trending lower, down to that 2% level. Listen to what she said about that.
I think it will continue to come down over time. That's my expectation. And, you know, I'm hopeful that we can certainly get into the twos.
Returning to the twos. So she's been pretty consistent in calling for a stronger U.S. economy, defying a lot of economists in the past few years who were expecting a recession, saying we're going to get a soft landing. She said it's been even stronger than she expected, which also gives her a little bit of leverage in these discussions with Beijing. I also just wanted to mention, Deirdre, that she took a lot of time for cultural visits, sites that are of importance to China. She did a private tour, for instance, of the Forbidden City at twilight. She spent 11 hours of talks and meetings with the vice premier, He Lefong, including a one-hour boat cruise in which I'm told they exchanged gifts. He gave her a portrait of herself on that cruise. She also went to a brewery today. That's how she wrapped up the trip. And it was a Chinese brewery, but she did have a beer that was made with American imported hops as an example.
Right.
a positive trade relationship where the U.S. actually exports to China.
You know, that food diplomacy is so important to especially the Chinese and just people at the level who are watching and so fascinated as to where she's going and what she's doing. I know on social media, it's alight with everything, following her every move. Sarah, I wonder how you're experiencing it. I know that you've been out. I heard you talking about EVs as well. I remember when living there as well, you couldn't access Twitter, Gmail, Facebook, Instagram very easily, and that's still the case. Does it kind of put it into perspective how popular TikTok is, for example, here in the United States, when many of our major apps, our major tech companies, are still banned over there?
Yeah, it's been really interesting to see the shift. Certainly, social media is big, and we've been monitoring the Weibo app to figure out the sentiment on the ground. And some of the anti-American sentiment, they have their own version of TikTok here, as you know, that's not called TikTok. And interestingly, since you mentioned social media, that did factor into the discussions. The Chinese raised it in discussions with her. I asked Secretary Yellen about it. She said that they were concerned about it, didn't really want to go into whether they would allow a sale of U.S. assets, for instance, to American investors or companies, but did reiterate that President Biden said that he would sign the legislation if it does pass the Senate. So clearly the Chinese are watching that. Mm-hmm. And on social media, the reaction to that is that folks say this is just another example of the U.S. politicizing economic issues, using national security to try to squash successful Chinese companies. And they look at TikTok as an example of that. But Deirdre, no question it's been an adjustment as far as using electronics here, not being able to access certain things. The cameras on every corner where you turn, the surveillance cameras, that was sort of a shock as well.
A very different approach. Very different approach to privacy. And so their AI is developing a lot differently. And that's part of what TikTok is about. Sarah, fantastic reporting on the ground there. Thank you for bringing us all of that.
Thank you.
So our next guest says the market may be reassured by Yellen placating Xi, but investors should prepare for rising tensions. For more here, let's bring in Derek Scissors, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Derek, thanks for being with us. You're skeptical of this trip. You say that the U.S. does need to maintain communication, but, and I'm reading from your notes here, the U.S. doesn't need two trips in 9 months by the Treasury Secretary. Why do you take that view?
Yeah. Well, I mean, what has happened in the last 9 months that the U.S. and China need to have face-to-face talks with the same person over? Nothing is the quick answer to that question. Secretary Yellen would say we need to talk about overcapacity. Overcapacity is a 20-year issue in China. There's nothing the U.S. is going to say to them that they don't already know. And, you know, adding to that, overcapacity is really an issue for the Secretary of Commerce and the United States Trade Representative. When Secretary Yellen says all trade remedies are on the table, she's not in charge of trade remedies. That is not the real reason for her visit.
So who should be there then? Or anyone at all?
Secretary I mean, if we really are concerned about a flood of Chinese goods in certain sectors and we are, feel obliged to take actions that we would prefer to avoid because we would prefer to avoid the flood of goods, Secretary Raimondo and USTR Tai are the people in charge of those measures and in charge of that issue. And they're not going there because of the reasons you mentioned in your report. Secretary Yellen is very popular in China, but her popularity in China is not a good reason for a visit.
So then what would success look like, Derek? Is this just sort of to keep the peace, or do you think that there's actual concessions to be won from China?
Oh, there are definitely no concessions to be won. And in fact, Treasury was saying that beforehand. Again, the Chinese system lends itself to overcapacity. They announce strategic sectors that get government support. You never hit market demand when you do that. You're always going to overshoot. So a visit by a U.S. Cabinet official saying this is a problem, that's not going to do anything. The way you would have had success is to say, look, we don't want to take these corrective measures, but if you continue with overproduction in EVs or whatever, what have you, we're going to put new tariffs and quotas on. It's not to have it set up a dialogue to talk about it. This issue has been beaten into the ground. We don't need to talk anymore.
Well, how do we know that's not happening behind the scenes? Because it feels like the broader point here is stabilization, right? You can't afford to have a more aggressive China, a more aggressive President Xi Jinping. So do you have to maintain sort of the status quo? And what's the actual threat you think that China does become more aggressive and moves on a region like Taiwan?
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to make an argument that we have to be nice to Xi Jinping all the time because otherwise his behavior will be worse, that could be true. That's fine. And then we send somebody who's a friend of China to try to placate him. But it won't last. And this would be my warning to the market. Your report stated this very well. Secretary Yellen is very respected in China. She's also going to turn 78 this year. And if President Biden wins re-election, she will not be the Secretary of the Treasury. We're going to lose the people of her age who remember a period of U.S.-China cooperation, and we're going to get younger people who see Xi Jinping as aggressive. Mm. So perhaps this is the right thing to do for the next 6 months, but it will not work in 2025 because we're not going to have another Secretary Yellen to make these visits and try to calm everyone down.
Is that what you mean when you say investors should prepare for rising tension? You don't see anyone else coming up in the pipeline who can be as popular?
Yes. I mean, you have a situation where Secretary Yellen has had a long and respected career, and she's very friendly to China. And, you know, that is a rare thing now. Younger people tend to remember more of Xi Jinping and less of the days of stronger U.S.-China cooperation. So even if President Biden wins, she's not going to be Treasury Secretary in 2025. And certainly if President Trump wins, she isn't. So we're going to get somebody who is very different from Secretary Yellen and not able to make these kinds of trips to try to keep the relationship under control.
Derek, thanks for your insights. Derek Scissors.
Thank you.
Coming up, Boeing back in the spotlight after a Southwest flight lost its engine cover during takeoff. We'll look at what's behind the latest headache for Boeing and what might be to blame. We're back right after this.
From a flat tire in the city to a dead battery on a distant drive, AAA is partnering with T-Mobile for Business to accelerate response times and get more drivers back on the road fast. Our nationwide connectivity powers location telematics, so AAA's fleet can find stranded drivers quickly while being fully equipped with the in-vehicle tools to have answers when they get there. This is elevating the member experience. This is AAA with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Welcome back to The Exchange, everybody. I'm Tyler Matheson with your news update. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced this afternoon that there is a date for an operation, a move militarily into Rafah. In a video statement today, Netanyahu said that an operation into Rafah was necessary to defeat Hamas, but did not provide any additional details. The announcement comes as negotiators spent the weekend in Cairo working on a possible hostage deal and ceasefire with Hamas. With a week left before his hush money trial begins, Donald Trump's attorneys filed a last-minute appeal to change the trial's venue and to stay the gag order, a source tells NBC News. Trump's team filed a special Article 78 motion to work around a New York state law that says an appeal cannot be filed until after a trial. And Beyoncé tops the Billboard charts again, her new album Cowboy Carter debuting at number one on the Billboard 200 and on the top country albums chart, making her the first black woman ever to top the list. Deirdre, back
Nothing
to you.
She can't do. Thank you, Tyler. See
we'll
you soon.
See you.
Still ahead, from startup to IPO and then a $4 billion sale to Amazon. Our next guest has seen it all, and now he's investing in the next generation of healthcare. We will get his strategy and where he sees the most opportunity for disruption. That is next. After underperforming last year, healthcare stocks are off to a better start this year, with the S&P Healthcare Index up nearly 5% so far in 2024. My next guest says after a two-year slump, the healthcare funding market is finally picking up as AI gets leveraged in the sector. He runs a venture capital firm backing healthcare startups that focus on innovation with tech and AI at the forefront. Joining me now is Amir Dan Rubin, Healthier Capital founding managing partner and CEO, also the former CEO of primary care provider One Medical that sold to Amazon. Amir, thanks for being with us today. Certainly, I usually sit in San Francisco, and a lot of the VCs and founders I talk to believe that healthcare is one of the most exciting spaces for AI disruption. Where are we seeing that disruption now at the earlier stages, and what's the opportunity?
Yeah, great to be with you. I think we're going to see it all over healthcare, both on the demand side, how consumers and employers interact with healthcare, and on the supply side, how we deliver healthcare more efficiently. Healthcare is a fifth of the economy, close to a fifth of the economy in the US, about 11% of GDP globally. So it's a massive opportunity. And really, consumers are struggling getting access to care. And then on the supply side, we're having a struggle finding labor and clinicians to get easy access. So automating a lot of healthcare is going to be really, really important as we head into the next decade.
Now, traditionally, though, healthcare has been a really tough industry to disrupt. We've seen the tech giants try and do so, from Amazon to Apple to Google with Verily. Is that changing? How is that going to change in the age of AI?
I think it is changing, because I think we've learned something in these last few years with the first batch of, if you will, digital disruptors. In healthcare, we often have to disrupt from within. We have to understand that we have commercial insurance and governmental programs, Medicare and Medicaid. We have FDA. We have privacy concerns. So as we apply technology, we need to overlay this technology on top of this infrastructure. And we're seeing a batch of companies do that now. Just as an example, I'm involved with a company, Ezra, that uses AI to accelerate MRI scans, so reduces time in scanners. And it's received FDA clearance. Or these other couple of companies, Octave, which connects people with therapists who take insurance. And recently at Cigna's Investor Day, they announced a big relationship with Octave. Or AMI is a program for serious mental illness that connects patients with serious mental illness with insurance in a clinical model. We're also looking at some really interesting company to automate on the supply side, looking at a company now that can help clinical researchers look for grants, normalize their data, and use large language models to apply for those grants. So these are all examples of companies, I would say, disrupting from within the ecosystem.
When we sort of look really broad, how AI and the application so far has been chatbots is going to affect people, affect humanity. There's this question of, is it going to make people more or less lonely? We couldn't have sort of seen all of these unintended effects of social media either. So I wonder what you think the impact is going to be on mental health.
Well, I think a few things. I think today, if you try to interact with the healthcare system, can you get somebody to answer the phone? Can you get a response if you have a question? I think these front-end aspects of interacting with healthcare, checking my insurance, checking for availability, I think those are things we can automate. The care, the compassion, the behavior change, I think we'll leverage technology, but this is where we hope to make humans more productive and give them more time and space to interact with people. Okay. So I think of itself, it shouldn't be a detriment, but we have to manage it.
For sure. I do want to ask you, because you sold your company to Amazon. It was one of Amazon's biggest acquisitions, One Medical. And Amazon itself has sort of this mixed record in healthcare. And I wonder, what do you think it ultimately wants to do here? Does it want to get into the employer healthcare market? Because so far, the success has been mostly on the consumer side.
Well, I think Amazon looks to problem statements where there is a significant gap between what people want and what's out in the marketplace. And if you look at the combination with One Medical and Amazon, One Medical had a membership subscription program that combined digital health and in-person care, and Amazon had a membership subscription program. And so that was a very nice combination. I think the other interesting thing about Amazon is Amazon can combine great technology, if you will, the AWS side of the house, with logistics. And so at some level, it also has a long-term perspective. So it's willing to work through things in the long term. I think Amazon has the kind of capabilities, the long-term perspective, the consumer focus, the ability to combine logistics and technology that's quite unique.
The Amazon flywheel. We could put it like that, too. Thank you so much, Amir, Dan Rubin. Thanks for being with us. Coming up.
My pleasure.
Boeing is back in the headlines after an engine cover fell off a Southwest Airlines plane during takeoff this weekend. We will have the latest. That's next. Another troubling headline for Boeing this weekend after a Southwest plane lost its engine cover on takeoff. Phil LeBeau is here with the very latest. Phil, what happened?
Hey, Deirdre, this is video that I think anybody who saw it, if you were on this flight, you were going, what is going on here? This was shortly after takeoff at Denver International Airport. Part of the engine covering, what's known as the cowling, was ripped off. It did not impact the engine, which continued to function, but they did come back to the airport, made an emergency landing. No injuries were reported. A couple of things to keep in mind here. The part of the engine that blew off here is the covering, the cowling. That's there in case there is ever an engine failure and it contain and it can keep the parts from flying into the fuselage. Southwest Maintenance is investigating. And while this is a Boeing 737-800, keep in mind that this was delivered in 2015. And I know the headlines, and we even did it in the tease. We said more headaches for Boeing. This is a maintenance issue. This is why, while Boeing and GE Aerospace, which makes the engine, they're assisting Southwest with its investigation. As you take a look at shares of Southwest, this is not considered a Boeing manufacturing issue. So keep in mind, as you take a look at shares of Southwest, the executive pay, which came out in their proxy statement last week, part of what will be determining the pay of Bob Jordan and other executives next year. How are things happening, or how? What is the status of things when it comes to safety as well as quality controls there? Also, don't forget, with regard to Boeing, we get the Q1 orders and deliveries tomorrow. Do not expect strong numbers given the fact that they have dramatically slowed down production for the 737 MAX.
Phil LeBeau, thank you. We know you'll be watching that closely. Coming up, the final countdown to the solar eclipse is on. Excitement is building. Places in the path of totality are getting ready. You are looking at a live pic of the eclipse from Mexico, and we are going to go live to Burlington, Vermont, with a check on the scene there and the expected economic impact of this event. Plus, world-renowned theoretical physicist Brian Greene, he's here as well. We're back in 2 minutes. Welcome back to The Exchange. We are geared. Welcome back. 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 Welcome back.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.